Okay. The date is July 17th. It is 1:20 p.m. and I am Brady Pricer.
I'm formally Manuel Irwin Coeur. My friends all call me Irv because I don't use my first name. I was born July 25th, 1928, which means I'll be 80 years old next week. And I hope that's part of probably this project. Born and raised in Philadelphia, went to the public schools in Philadelphia, went to Temple University for a bachelor's and master's degree, and a PhD at the University of Missouri.
Okay. Can you kind of explain your affiliation with the university from the beginning?
I was an instructor at Temple University and a debate coach. I decided I didn't want to continue as a debate coach, so I started looking for a job, and there was a position open here. And I came out here and was interviewed by Dr. Weisenfluh. This was 1961, summer of 1961. And I joined what was then the speech department at the time. By the way, I guess they had just changed the name from Slippery Rock State Teachers College to Slippery Rock State College. They took out the teachers. Mm-hmm. But there were no programs here at the time except teacher preparation.
Yeah.
And there was a teaching certificate in speech. And speech at the time, I guess, before I came, was sort of subsumed under the English department because there were only 2.5 instructors. And, or, I guess it was 2.5, wait, 3.5 now I think of what it was. And with me, it made 4.5. So by as the year went on, because I was the one with the most formal education, I was listed as an associate professor. I was ABD, that means I hadn't finished my dissertation, which is another reason I had to stop being a debate coach. And so I ended up being informally the chairperson, and the following year they made me the chair of the then separated speech department.
Now, did you know Carl Lochner?
Carl Lochner, Helen Cushman, Milt Carlos. At some points before I came, Carl Lochner's wife Norma taught halftime. Mm-hmm. That's why I said it was a half first. And then myself, yeah.
We just had both of them in about 2 weeks ago.
I'm glad you did that, of course, because the two of them go back much farther than I do. And Norma's a native to Slippery Rock, and probably her family has long attachments to the university. Mm-hmm. In many, many forms.
Okay, we have a section for the transitional period. You already mentioned, you know, dropping the teachers part right. of the title. Do you remember any specific events or have any memories from those transitional periods?
Oh, yeah, I think it was the spring of 1962. 63, it was the following year. Yeah, it was the following year. Although we had no longer had the teachers officially in the name, we had no liberal arts programs. Now, understand that we had teacher preparation programs for secondary education. We had all the normal liberal arts departments that you could think of. Maybe a little weak in philosophy, but by and large we had art and music and English and obviously speech and drama. The theater was part of the speech department and so on. And so we get it, the president called us together, and at that point I was officially a department chair, and said we need to draft a curriculum for a liberal arts program, and we think if we do this and move quickly, we can get it approved. So my recollection is, I may be off a year, but my recollection is it was the spring of 1963, that we sat down, decided what would make up a liberal arts degree, a Bachelor of Arts, because before that all we had a Bachelor of Science in Education. And it got approved, and we were authorized to offer liberal arts degrees beginning that fall. Hmm. And I think we had one student in our department, as I recall, who was a liberal arts major. She must have been my advisor. His name was Jack. Her mother was a school teacher here in the city. Yeah, that was, the politics of the thing, in a sense, was that the private liberal arts colleges didn't really want competition from the state college system. And the state college system, now I'm going back, I wasn't here, but if you're going back, I finished undergraduate school in 1949 and got a grad at Temple. I got an assistantship in the speech department and taught as a grad assistant for a couple of years before I went off to the University of Missouri to work on my doctorate. Schools had exploded with the benefits of the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. There was a huge demand for higher education. And the schools were for one thing, they were looking for faculty members, but space, etc. Lots of schools took advantage of that to take their teachers' colleges and make them multi-purpose institutions. Not Pennsylvania. Remember, I'm not talking the late 40s. I'm talking 15 years later. And they had never made that transformation. Obviously, I would say it's political pressure with the State Board of Higher Education, whoever supervises the degree approval, to avoid competition. So we finally broke through. And if either of you are arts majors, liberal arts majors, you know about the language requirements and the things we stuck in.
Yeah, yeah, we both. Okay.
So that's, wait a minute. I told you about the department, yeah. Other positions. I never held any administrative positions. I never was hired as a department chair.
Okay.
At some point, I realized I didn't wasn't going to be a dean. I should stop even thinking about it.
What buildings did you work in?
When I first came, our offices were on the third floor of Old Main. At that point, the third floor had classrooms and had some offices. And I'm trying to think at what point the building that's now used, I guess, by the grad school over here on what's the little street that comes up off of Main and onto the campus?
Keystone.
Well, Maltby.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I think it is the graduate or continuing ed over there still across from the library. The old library across from the library.
Yeah, the old library.
Whatever that building is. It may have been even that fall. The college had purchased that building. It had been a private residence.
Oh, the Lowry Center.
The Lowry Center. Thank you. And I did know Bob Lowry also. So the four of us in this speech department and a couple of people in the English department were sent over there along with other strays, a couple of people in elementary age. And we still taught our classes down at Old Main, but we had offices up here. Now the following year, after the new field house opened and the phys ed people vacated East Gym, Dean said to me, you only teach small classes, you know, speech classes, usually 25 people most. Why don't you take East Gym because the classrooms in there are pretty small. So we moved the whole speech and theater department. Well, of course, the theater people hung out at the Miller Auditorium, but they taught their classes other than their theater classes because they also taught public speaking. We were over at East Gym and we stayed in East Gym, West Gym, where there are four small classrooms, first and second floor. I had the office in that rotunda there. That I was chair, that was my office. We were over there until, must have been about 71, because as long as I was chair, and I got tired of being chair because I got tired of dealing with the dean. I was chair, I guess, up until about the spring of 1971, and Ted Walwood replaced me. And then shortly after that, we moved down to Eisenberg, and I guess they've been there ever since.
Yeah.
Eisenberg had been completed. It was being built. I remember sitting on the committee that dealt with, talked to the architect about what we wanted in the building. Of course, we didn't get it, but that's a whole other story. I wanted radio studios.
Yeah.
I wanted potential television studios. I wanted coaxial cable, which was the form you used then, so that we could put these little things like this in all the classrooms and take the kids, but didn't get any of it.
Well, they've changed some things.
Well, we've got it now, but it's in self-contained systems. The old system would have been to run a major cable out of each room into a central control room.
Okay. You said you were from Philadelphia originally.
Yeah.
Had you known about Slippery Rock at that point before you applied here?
I knew there was a state college system because at one point in my high school days, I contemplated going to Westchester. And then I thought I didn't want to be a secondary school teacher, so I gave up on that and went to Temple. You know, when I was explaining this to somebody the other day, I lived at home. I could commute to school, but I didn't have much money. You want me to tell you what tuition was in those days? Tuition at Temple was $100 a semester plus fees.
Oh,
and I had a half scholarship to boot. So, you know, I made a choice. So I go to Westchester, I have to live in the dorm, pay room and board, and very modest tuition. I could pay a little more tuition at Temple and live at home. Of course, I'd have to pay car fare, or subway fare, actually. but it was easy for me to get to school, to commute to school, and so I stayed at home, and my mother fed me and did my laundry, and I went to school.
Okay, what were your first impressions when you came to Slippery Rock? What did you first think?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think that this is, you may hear this from other people. My wife is from Chicago, and so we were big city kids. Now, we had both gone to the University of Missouri, where we met, which was a small college town, but the university probably, by the way, the university was obviously a major state university, had maybe 6,000 or 7,000 students, including the graduate students, the law students, the med students, and so on. And a town of maybe 30,000, 35,000 people, I guess pretty much like Buckner. So we'd never been in a town this small. And so we come to Slippery Rock, and you think, oh. And then we think, you know, it's probably a good place to raise kids. I had 3 kids under 3 when I came. That's another story. And we thought, this will be all right. And like a lot of other people, all right, we'll give it a couple of years. I'll finish my degree. I'll get a couple of years experience, because if you change jobs too often, people ask, why did you change jobs? And then we'll see if we want to look around for another position, you know? But we settled in, we made friends, the kids were happy, we were happy, we liked living in a small town, and decided, okay, this is fine, we'll stay with it.
Did your wife work at the university too?
No. She stayed home and raised the kids until they were teenagers, and then she worked part-time. The apartments, what's it called now, Pine Grove, or what's it?
Yeah, Pine Glen.
Pine Glen on, all right, I can't remember what the prior name was.
They used to be College Garden apartments.
College Gardens, yeah. And there was College Gardens West over on Cooper Street, College Gardens on Easter Road. My wife Lois, the was owned by a consortium, I guess, I don't know, partnership would probably be more accurate, one of whose members, Jerry Cheston, was a faculty member in the elementary education. We lived in those days, when we first came, we lived in the house where Rock Realty is, that ancient red brick house up on 173, about a mile north of, essentially across from the hardware store. And it's been remodeled, because when Lee Ligo bought it from me, he changed it into his office building and so on. But I owned the house, the kids lived there. It was great, it was country living. They had an acre of ground to run around, and they had trees to climb in, the dog chased them around the place, and everybody was very happy. We could go sledding on the hill back there and stuff like that. We were enjoying ourselves. But we had an old house, and we decided we would like a nice air-conditioned house that wasn't full of molds. So we built a house on Park Lane Drive, and one of our neighbors was Jerry Cheston, and he needed somebody to manage, be the office managers for these 2 sets of apartments. My wife worked there part-time, like 8 or 10 hours a week, a couple hours a day. By the time the kids were able to come home from school and stay out of trouble. So she did that for many years, and then eventually she worked for the welfare department in Butler, which caused us to eventually, after the kids left home, to relocate to Butler. So she wouldn't have to commute as much.
Yeah.
Okay. But no, my wife never did that. For whatever. Well, she wasn't an academic, she only had a bachelor's degree.
Can you talk about your campus activities in terms of committees, things like that you're ever part of?
That's part of all kinds of things. Obviously, I've served on a lot of different committees over the years, mm-hmm. I mean, internal, external. I suppose the most important thing to say is I had, because of being the University of Missouri at Temple, I belonged to the American Association of University Professors. There was no, as I recall, there was no AAUP chapter when I first came here. The faculty had their major affiliation professional. Pardon me. I'm going to stop the tape.
Yeah, we can. All right.
Now, the faculty had an affiliation with the Pennsylvania State Education Association under the title of the American, the Association of Pennsylvania State College Faculties, which eventually got changed to ABSCO, mm-hmm. when they got the university status. And that was basically a political lobbying arm, because our salaries and salary schedules, as well as the university's budget, of course, were part of the state legislative package. When I was hired, the salary was set by a law, and I can't remember which one it was, but I mean, I met the qualifications for associate professor. Dr. Weisenfluh said, what are you getting at Temple? And I told him, and he said, well, I guess we can give you an increment over that, or two increments, or whatever. And he offered me what I thought was a pretty generous salary, and so I took the job, and then we had 5%. And it was a structure where, I think it was 7 steps, each 5%, all over the base in each faculty rank. And then they overlap. You had to have a doctorate to be a full professor. After I finished my dissertation, got my doctorate, I got promoted to full professor. I was doing very nicely, at least comfortably, of course. But we had to have somebody to go down and pester with the people in Harrisburg for on our behalf. So we had this. So in those days, we had both organizations. I think it cost us $5 to belong to EBSCOF, and I don't know what AAUP was, maybe $10. Then when the Collective Bargaining Act went through, the Public Employee Act 195, if memory serves me right, went through about 1970, permitting public employee bargaining. The question was, is the faculty going to unionize? Now, the maintenance staff were quick to unionize, AFSCME was going to, and from my perspective, hell, if all the maintenance people are unionized, they'll be harassing management for raises, we better unionize also. Besides, I grew up in a union family, so to me it seemed like the obvious thing to do. And we had a bargaining election, so here I am. In those days, I think, what do you call if I was president of AUP at that point, but I was on sabbatical, I wasn't doing anything, I'd been on sabbatical. When I came home from sabbatical, they said to me, which group do you want to support? We're having an election in the fall. And the State Education Association people had hired a union organizer who had worked for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. Harry, I can't think of his name, he'll come back to me. And I thought, they're the best bet. So I threw in my lot with that, and I was actually, at some point over the summer, I think, filled the vacancy and became president of the AFSCUF PSEA affiliated, you know, on the ballot. It was campaign for that. The AAU people, I don't know if you'll interview any of them, Rhoda Taylor was one of the active in that, and others. We won the election, and I was the first president of AFSCUF for about a year, and I think it was Don Voss replaced me. So I was the president when the election was held, and I don't think I was the president when we signed the first contract. But I was active thereafter. After I lost being president, I think I did other things. I worked briefly as their legislative person. I spent many years as chairman of the grievance committee, the faculty grievance committee. And obviously, I'm not going to tell you the details. In fact, I probably would have burned the files. But we had a few faculty members who do stupid things and get themselves into trouble and other problems. Faculty members who just don't get along with other faculty members. It was a very interesting job. I ended that one. I think when I had heart surgery at some point, I had to resign. So that's what I did mostly in that sense. Even when we were still AAUP is when we went through the Bob Carter mess. President Carter. Yep. Okay, here I was active in the AAUP chapter. And I had personally taken a dislike to President Carter, but as did many faculty members. And when the faculty members made that known, actually probably were almost indirectly invited to make it known by the Board of Trustees, some of whom were also disenchanted with him. He, of course, resigned. I don't know how much of that you want me to get into at the moment. And we sent a letter. Now, in the previous hiring process, when Weisenfluh left, and there was an interim president whose name I don't remember, and then Carter came in, and that's a mess. anybody told you about it?
Well, we've heard a little bit, but we can ask you this in another section and kind of go through it.
Okay. When that went through, we had nothing to do with hiring Bob Carter. I mean, the faculty wasn't consulted. We were just told he's the new president, you know, like that. And so we decided that's not the way it ought to be. So we wrote a letter to the Board of Trustees on behalf of the AUB chapter and said, you know, we think the faculty should be consulted. And we appointed a committee to meet with you. But of course, I was on the committee, Martha Haverstick. Who else was it? Bob Crane, maybe? And was the head of the chemistry department. And in the course of this, I realized that this Board of Trustees, I better be polite, didn't know how to proceed. And they appointed, if I looked at the list, one of the board members lived here in town. Her husband had been head of the science department, if I recall correctly, and I can't think of her name. She lived up on Center Street Extension. They appointed her to sort of be the interface with us. Well, it quickly became clear that we were going to do much of the screening and make suggestions, actually handle some of the applicants. And ultimately that ended up, so we got involved in the selection with Dr. Watchwell, who came to us. He'd been an intern in a program, I think at San Jose State in California, where some foundation was in the business of sponsoring would-be college presidents for internships in college administration. I guess he'd been a dean up at Portland State in New York. And he looked like the guy who was the right guy for us. He took the position. We were under a lot of heat from Middle States to fill the vacancy. They were a little bit upset. I think Middle States felt that every time there was a change in the controlling of the governorship or the control of the state, they changed presidents of the state colleges, or at least they started looking for new ones, you know, pushed them out. They just thought there was too much both formal partisan political interference and too much interference between local townspeople, you know, that the boards were too close to both the faculty and the community to maintain some distance from it, that they let personal politics and policies get in the way. And they wanted to make it, we just showed up at a time when they wanted to make a statement and we caught all the heat.
Yeah.
So they were under considerable pressure to replace Carter promptly. Bob Lowry served briefly as the interim president. Well, that was a big mess. I hope it's in the records.
Well, you know,
he was signing the checks, is what I did, so to speak.
You know, with the section about presidents, can you kind of talk about the presidents that you recall working with and some of the details about it?
I remember walking into Old Main one day, and I was like, they still have all the pictures of the presidents hanging downstairs, and looking at it all, and I looked at, you know, I started with Weisenflug, and retired, I guess, as president when I retired.
Was it Ebersole?
Yeah, it must have been Bob Ebersole, sure. And I looked at them and thought, how few of them had left voluntarily. Weisenflug was pushed out. The guy who served, Weisenflug had gone on sabbatical. The man who was dean of students, we didn't have a little bit, that was the title there, it wasn't vice president. Was acting president in his absence for a spring semester. Board of Trustees, have you heard this before?
Not
the Board of Trustees, these at a June meeting or something like that, whatever they're having, their quarterly meeting, suddenly decided that they need a retirement policy. And they declared that no faculty member or president should serve after the semester in which he turned 65. Weisenflug had just turned 65. So in effect, they sent him a telegram or a letter or something. He was in Florida or somewhere and told him that this was the new policy and they would replace him effective in the fall. So out he went. there was a shift, I guess, from the Leader administration or the Schaab administration, I forget the name, Schaab, the Democrats, to whoever replaced them. It'll come back to me, I guess, whatever Republican replaced them. And the board now had, was under the control of Republicans instead of Democrats, is what had happened. So as I was about to say, get back to that kind of stuff. So they put him as interim president, this guy. But as soon as they hired Bob Carter, which they did in the middle of the spring semester, and they told him to take office immediately. He was teaching at Denison. And he said, oh, I have to finish out my semester. And they said, oh, well, all right. So I think he changed his teaching schedule so he could get a long weekend. And he would come up here every year, every other weekend. The interim president was still here, living in the he asked if he could live in the president's house. Weisenfeld left town, went to Elizabethtown. And Carter, he had asked the board if he'd stay till the end of the semester. He had a kid in high school or something, but they finished the term, and then he would move on. And I guess he felt he had permission to stay. And Carter suddenly decided when the semester ended and he wanted to relocate from Denison, which was like the 1st of June, that he wanted the house. The other guy said, I won't be out of here for 2 weeks or something. Carter told him to turn off the water and the utilities. It made Time magazine. That's not very complimentary to your institution. And the rest of us sat there and said, who the hell did they hire? You know, what kind of guy is this? And that set the whole thing going for three difficult years. Anyhow, Carter then came in and, of course, managed to offend even the Board of Trustees in time, and so he resigned, encouraged by a vote of no confidence. At that point, you asked me about my role. I was second. Yeah. Carter decided that, very traditional thinking, the president of the university, or college at the time, was the president of the faculty. And therefore, we used to meet annually. We used to meet once a month. The entire faculty met. Of course, at one point, we'd all fit in one room. We used to meet once a month. The president would conduct a faculty meeting once a month, the whole faculty. And so Carter said, okay, we need a constitution for their bylaws, I guess, for the faculty. We ought to have a bylaws. Well, that would be a good idea. Remember, I was active in the AUP. So we were going to work out what was the relationship, powers relationship between the president and the faculty. So Mark Selman, who was in the political science department and had a history of working in state government, so was assistant to the president, he assigns Mark to meet with us to work out the details. It ended up being it was the most extensive bargaining session I ever had in my later experience as a union member, officer, you know. We bargained for all summer on what would be in this bylaws for the faculty, what we could and couldn't do and how we would meet. And the highest faculty officer, the only elected faculty officer actually, was the secretary, and I was it. I was the secretary. And Bob Carter presided as the president. And in his absence, I guess the dean of students, no, the dean, whatever the academic dean was. I don't remember using the title provost in those days. I would preside. And so the time came when the word went around one day. One of my friends, Bob Duncan, was chairman of the social science department. He was pretty well plugged in, came to me and said, would you sign a petition to the board saying that we would think that it was time for Bob Carter to go? I forget exactly how it was. If that's going around, and I looked at the signatures, then, you know, they would be doing this if they didn't know it would be well received. Mm-hmm. So I signed the thing. And then we were scheduled to have a faculty meeting, and we had decided we were going to move a motion of no confidence. And I said to the meeting, what do we do if somebody wants a secret ballot? So I went to the meeting carrying a briefcase, the minutes and the usual notes, and enough blank paper for secret ballots. And Bob Carter stood up, and the names are getting away from me, because I remember who he asked to make the motion. And he did, and Bob Carter said, that's the way it is. And I recall it very good, may have walked out, but he understood what was going on. And he said, I'm going. And he committees that he had, because every college has to have somebody in place as an acting president in case something happens, he had had it devolve on Mark Selman. Now, normally it would devolve on the senior academic officer, whatever his title was. Nowadays it would be vice president and provost, or it might have been dean of instruction at one time, you know, or vice president for academic affairs, whatever the title was. Mark was just assistant to the president, so this was kind of ignoring the chain of command I did. And so Mark acted like he was the acting president for a while until the board met, I guess, and said no, and home with Bob Lowry. And so we had several interregnums there until that resolved, and Wattrell came and everything quieted down again. Until now, Wattrell, I guess, I don't know the details of this one, ran afoul of Jim Roberts, I guess. I don't know what the conflict was, but Wattrell got pushed out. Mm-hmm. And Wattrell got pushed out with 9 years of service, and he needed 10 years to vest his pension, and was a little upset about it. So he obviously, you know, in some respects, college presidents are like baseball managers. They all understand the perils of the job, and they sort of try to help each other. But Wattrell got pushed out before he wanted to go. He ended up at the North Dakota, I think it's, where is he, all the way up, is it Aberdeen? He's up in Aberdeen, South Dakota, I think that's where he is. He ended up at State College in the Dakotas. So, you know, he had a tough year somewhere along the line, and got himself another presidency. Yeah. Just like baseball managers always end up somewhere, somebody finds them a job, whether they're scouting or doing something. So, yeah, that was Wattrell, and don't ask me who comes after all that.
Okay.
If you name one, I'll tell you what I know about it. By the way, even though the two current ones, I'm on very friendly terms with both Smiths.
Oh, yeah. Let's see, who was after that? It would have been, yeah, after Wattrell. That would have, in the 80s, right? It would have been after.
Yeah, it was the guy came up from Florida. Stayed 4 or 5 years. Left voluntarily to take a job in Kentucky. And then I think Abersol came along, because by then he was the vice president.
Okay. Do you have had any people that influenced you when you first arrived or while you were here?
What I'm saying, yeah.
Any people that influenced you while you were here when you first came?
Staff members. Mm-hmm. Well, Carl Ochter and Bill Carlos always talked like they hired me. they would talk to me like they were my big brother, you know, like, well, we took care of you. running a department when there are only 4, 5, 6 people, it wasn't much of an administrative problem. Actually, when I first came, all the scheduling and class assignments were done by the dean of instruction, so I didn't even control that. As soon as I got control of that, I saw to it I didn't have any Saturday classes. We used to have Saturday classes. I didn't have any 8 o'clock classes. I'm not a morning person. On the other hand, Carlos would come in and say, I'd say, what do you want to do with the theater people? You know, what theater classes do you want to offer? He'd tell me. And he'd tell me what he wanted to offer them. And he'd tell me what classes he wanted. He always wanted to teach first. You have to understand that. I was very fortunate. He liked to teach 8 o'clock classes. He wanted to teach from 8 to noon. Go home, take a nap, and come back in the evening, rehearse his plays. You see, I wanted to come wandering in around 9:30 in the morning, teach for them when everybody left at mid-afternoon. I could sit down in the office and write letters or memos because nobody was around. So we got along fine, you know. The department grew. We added a couple of people. 1963, we added a technical theater person, so there were two of them over there. Oh, only that department grew. Eventually, they split theater off, put it in a separate department, and so on. Who else? Bob Duncan, who I mentioned, was chairman of social studies, was a personal friend, and had been here a long time, I think, understood things, played bridge with him for many years. Ray Nisswanger, who came the same year I did, was the president, chairman of the English department, was another personal friend, by another Philadelphian. Different part of town. I don't have to tell you about that kind of thing.
Okay.
People on staff. I mean, we had a good put working relations with my colleagues. I don't think I ever had problems with my colleagues in the speech room. You know, speech change. Somewhere in the early 70s, after Ted Waldron came in, it's to me, it's marketing. They decided that communication sells better than speech. But it also represented the fact that we were no longer primarily into public speaking, interpersonal communications, or speech therapy, that type of stuff. We were going to get more and more into the mass media. We had always taught the radio class, we started that at television. So then when we moved over that way, and of course, as I said, as that progressed, when they finally reorganized somewhere in the late 80s and created a business school, the School of Business and Information Sciences, Ted put out, interacted with Dean Mastriani, is that his name? Yeah. And we went over in the Business and Information Sciences. Theater got split off and went over to what eventually became Fine Arts, of course. I think initially they were just over at Liberal Arts, where that got reorganized. So the department was more and more focused on mass media, and it represents a shift in some respects from thinking of communication as a humanistic study with some aspects that are social science to one that's perhaps more heavily social sciences, number crunching and type of stuff, and less humanistic. I'm a rhetorician. I trace my discipline back to Aristotle and Plato. Maybe even before that. And knowing, of course, that there are ways to test the efficacy of principles of effective communication using, you know, numerical or structured studies. But still at heart, you listen to a speech or read a speech, critique it on the basis of the same as an English teacher would critique a work of literature. I mean, you obviously look at other things in a English teacher looks at, because you don't just look at the content of the message, you look at the environment it was given. English teachers might do, English people might do that too. There's a shift in where the discipline's going, but that was not true for Slippery Rock, it was true nationally. And the national organizations are now all, it's the National Communication Association. That reminds me of something. I was active in the Pennsylvania Speech, what was then the Pennsylvania Speech Association, then the Speech, you know, they changed their name and now the Pennsylvania Communication Association. So I'm a past president of that, past editor of their annual. So I did my turn, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Do you have any major events or activities you remember when you were here in terms of national significance or things that happened on campus?
I gave a lecture a couple of years ago for the Institute of Learning and Retirement. Eleanor Roosevelt came here to speak in the spring of 1962. Okay? She's getting on in years. In fact, she died within a few months of being here. Oh, you asked me who influenced me. I got to tell you about Emmy Guthrie Miller. You started to laugh. Do you know whom I'm talking about?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Emma was on the board and as a board member. And that would not have caused me to know her. The reason I knew Emma Guthrie Miller is my wife got pulled into two activities while we were here, which made her happy. One is she got involved with the Slippery Rock Democratic Women's Club, of which Emma Guthrie Miller was the good gray eminence. the name, nowadays, I think they may even call it the Emma Guthrie Miller Democratic Women's Club. But in those days, she was still alive, and she was obviously a member, and if she showed up, the club revolved around her, okay? And I'm trying to think of my wife ultimately became president of the club. The other thing is my wife got pulled into Girl Scouting. I have three daughters, and was a troop leader. And she had a degree in journalism, so one day somebody said, would you help edit the whatever the newsletter is for the Keystone Tall Tree Girl Scout Council? And beginning with that, she ended up being first a board member and an officer and ultimately the president of the Keystone Girl Scout Council for several years. And because of that, she said to me, you understand some numbers, I'm putting you on the finance committee. So I'm a life member of Girl Scouts. So I was active with the Girl Scouts, but in an administrative capacity. I occasionally did a little teaching and meeting procedure and stuff for them, but I did, except for helping my wife with the girls, I never was a leader. You know, so we had a nice life here at Slippery Rock, involved in community activity. Now, going back to Emma Guffey Miller, here I know a prominent board member. She's the Democratic National Committee woman from Pennsylvania. Do you know why Miller wrote a tort in his name for her? Did anybody try to get this story? Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you the story as I've heard it, because it may be apocryphal. I told you Weisenflu was in under the Democratic leadership. I think Emma may have been chairman of the Board of Trustees in those days. By the way, the board didn't have that much power then anymore, and it has a great deal of power now. In those days, there was a Bureau of Higher Education within the State Department of Education, and that Bureau granted 14 state teachers' colleges, which were seen, of course, as part of the process of running the public school system. And each one was responsible for certain disciplines, and arts, phys ed. Everybody did elementary and secondary ed, and everybody did something more. We did phys ed, Edinburgh did art, IUP did business. Westchester, I guess music's down on IUP and stuff like that. Industrial arts is in California. But anyhow, here we be. So I knew a board member. All right, the story is that in those days, the capital budget for putting up buildings was passed by the legislature every 2 years. They didn't meet as much as they do now. And Emma came in, I don't know whether she, why or how she was on campus, but she went to see Dr. Weisenflu, the president. You know, his office in those days was on the first floor. And he said, I'm glad you came in. I'm having a problem. The legislature is considering the capital budget. We're anxious to get this auditorium through because otherwise it'll be held up a couple of years. And do you think you could help us? She said, sure, could I use your phone? This is the way the story was told to me, not by her. So she picks up the phone and she calls Davy Lawrence, that's whose name I couldn't think of, then governor of Pennsylvania, you know, in the conversation, I can visualize this, I knew him well enough to, Davy, this is Emma. Yes, Emma, what can I do for you? I'm over here at Slippery Rock at the president's office. It's important that the funding for the new auditorium go through now before it'll be delayed. I'll see what I can do, or whatever. I don't know the text exactly what happened. All I know is it got approved. And, you know, she had that kind of connection to get it done. And so what else could they do but name the place for her? By the way, when it was built, which it came online, I think, in 1970, when I got here in 61, it had already been in use about a year. There's a little theater in the basement of the Maltby, the mm-hmm. library down there, that they used to use. Seats maybe 150 people. Miller seats 800 and some. Miller was intended to seat the entire student body. Okay. Tells you what's happened to the place. Or why we need a new one, yeah.
Yeah.
So but Emma was, knowing Emma was something else. When I was active at the Pennsylvania Speech Association, each year we give out a certificate, an award to the Speaker of the Year. We'd given it to Fred Rogers, I'm trying to think who else, we probably gave it to Davy Lawrence. I mean, prominent people of all kinds, but not necessarily politicians. And 1 year at the executive committee, I suggested we give it to Emma Guffey Miller. And they looked at me and I told them a little bit about her and they knew who she was. So we were meeting in Pittsburgh that year, so we had agreed to give it to Emma and she agreed to come. I was in Pittsburgh, my wife brought her down, but she didn't. And happened to know Emma because Lois tells me as soon as she got there, she said, I need a cocktail. And so they went into the lounge and she got a cocktail. This was before, I guess it was a dinner meeting, I think it was in the afternoon. And she came on and she gave this nice extemporary speech of my life in politics, how I started out as a little kid. Her father was sheriff of. Lived in Greensburg. Are you from Pennsylvania?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think what county it is. Westmoreland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My father was sheriff of Westmoreland County when she was a kid, I guess, or something like that. She grew up in politics. I think she's remembering when she started talking about her first recollection of political contest. I think it was 1884 or something. She graduated from Bryn Mawr, 1901 or some such. If I brought my notes, I could tell you. I said I gave a lecture on her at one point. And So she'd been in politics all her life. She gave this long, rambling speech. My former colleague of mine, actually, he was both a colleague and a professor of mine, both at Temple and Missouri, because he changed. He went from Temple after I left to Missouri, where I still was, and was working for Smith, Kline, and French, now taken over by somebody else, as their in-house communications person who trained details men on their sales pitches. And they would go around and give speeches to rotaries, service clubs, and other groups on developments in pharmaceuticals. So that's what he did. Bob Hawkinson was his name. So Bob, we had taped the speech, and Bob arranged to have it to do what you're going to do, to have his secretary transcribe it. Because then we told Emma we'd print it, but it was an interesting speech. Mm-hmm. So they sent it to Emma and suggested that if she wanted to edit it, I would help her with it. So I ended up making several trips. She lived out here on West Border Street. You go right across Wolf Creek, on the far side of Wolf Creek. So she'd call me up and she'd say, "Irving, this is Emma. Can you come out at 5 o'clock today or tomorrow?" No more than that. And I say, "Yes, Mrs. Miller." "Well, I'll see you then." She's part of hearing, so there's no point in trying to carry on a conversation. So I drive out there, and a typical meeting would go something like this. I'd arrive, and I'd come in, and her housekeeper would say, she'll be down in a few minutes, and I'd wait. And then she'd come down, and she'd say, "Come with me." And she'd take me into the, what I guess is technically the butler's pantry, and she'd get a tray of ice cubes out of the refrigerator, and she'd put them in an ice cube thing. And she'd take a bottle of bourbon and I got it in the sitting room, and she got a glass and put some cubes in it, pour herself a couple inches of bourbon and handed the bottle and say, "I never pour for a gentleman." So I'd pour some whiskey in there and I would drink it. The whiz would sip, and then we'd go over the manuscript. I think about two round trips did it on that case. I had previously helped a friend, Charles Holt, who taught social studies at Eton. Charlie had, for his doctoral dissertation at, if I can recall correctly, it was Syracuse, had written a dissertation about Emma's brother, who was a United States senator, served two terms from 1964 to 1946. And we had gone out and taped Emma so that he could have a record to work with when he was working on his dissertation. And I had run, in those days, reel-to-reel tape recorder. He took me along. I had the tape recorder and I knew what to do with it. So I had met Emma on those occasions. So she and I were in good terms. She was a real character. And occasionally she'd have some sort of gathering, whatever. Lois got invited because she was one of the local Democrats, you know. She always showed up to the annual picnic of the Democratic Women's Clubs. And so knowing her was one of the most interesting people I've ever met. A mentor? No. I'll finish the story up. When the Bob Carter thing blew up, although Bob was brought in by the Republicans on the board, and Emma was a good Democrat, she was still on the board. And we decided at the meeting in which the board was going to consider what to do about Bob Carter that we would go sit in on the theory it was an open meeting. In those days, there was no formal law that made meetings open. You know, the Sunshine Law or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was before it was passed, but we just presumed it was, and we knew the meeting was going to be held down at the field house in the conference room. So about a dozen of us showed up and sat down while the board was having lunch. And they came in and walked in. Turned to George Keister, who, local judge in those days, who was chairman of the board, and said, "Who are these people?" And George said, "This is your faculty." And she was a little upset with this. And I can tell you that. My youngest daughter went to Northeastern, and I was in Boston one time, and Emma's papers are up at the Schlesinger Collection on women's papers. They're not here. What's here is some odds and ends. There is stuff here, but the important stuff is all up in Radcliffe, in the Schlesinger Collection on Women's History. So I go up and I look, get out his papers to see if there's anything. I keep thinking, some days I toy with the idea of writing a biography or something. It's more labor than I'm planning. And I find myself in the index. And somebody, Lila, the board member from Slippery Rock, had written her a letter and told her about who were the activists who were sitting in the lab car. So there I am, buried in the documents. Wherever we are, ramble on to the next question.
Okay, well, what do you miss about being at SRU?
I don't miss very much at all. When I retired, my wife's dead, but she was still alive at that point. We'd come over here and we could audit classes, and so we took some classes. And then when she died, I continued to take classes. Then we organized this ILR, the Institute for Learning and Retirement, and I was one of the founders of it. And I teach, and I take classes. What more could I want to do? You teach the things you feel like doing. Mostly I run the public, the current affairs discussion group. Occasionally I've done other things like this lecture I gave on Emma Guffin Miller and Eleanor Roosevelt. And so I work with people who want to be there, who aren't required to be there to meet some curriculum degree necessity. And I sit in on classes with people whose teaching I appreciate. I learned something once in a while. You're somebody I don't think too well of, but that's beside the point. And you learn what you need to learn. I don't have to worry about exams. Even when I was auditing classes, I didn't take the final exams.
Okay. What words of wisdom do you have for current or future Rock community members?
For whom?
Current or future Rock community members.
Rock community.
Yeah.
And you define community as faculty or students?
Everybody.
As far as students are concerned, because I wish they had more breadth of curiosity. Mm-hmm. That's all. They seem to be in. Now remember, I taught a fair portion of my teaching load to the day I retired in required courses, and the saving grace is they like to teach in one or two advanced courses. And the kids in the required grade, I say kids, of course, they're 18, 19, 20 tops, and you're older than that. The kids are, they want to get a degree. They're here to get credits, diplomas, then I suppose entry to the world of work. And in many cases, their interest is, what do I need to know to pass the exam and get a grade, whatever grade I've decided I want now. I have a feeling a lot of kids came into a public speaking class and said, I'll be happy for a C, when with a little effort, they could have had a B or an A. Mm-hmm. And so they're somewhat limited. The good question, in a sense, whether it's actually said or not, is, will it be on the exam? What can I learn from this today? That's what's nice about teaching seniors who show up voluntarily. That's my advice to the kids. And frankly, I have the same attitude for my grandson who's about to start college. I have a feeling he's got tunnel vision too. Now, as far as the faculty, some of that carries over to the faculty. When I finished my oral exams for my doctorate, they shook my hand and said, welcome to the community of scholars. And there was still some of this attitude that there was such a thing as a community of scholars, that we were educated people with broad interests. A desire to know things. And sometimes I think that there are a lot of people floating around with many with doctoral degrees, and you're still students, you need to figure that out for yourself, who know a lot about a little and don't care much about anything much else. Now, it may be generational. It may be that they care a lot about things that I don't care about. I know that's true, for example, in music. I like classical music. We grew up going to hear the Philadelphia Orchestra as a kid. I mean, from the time I was a teenager on, if I wasn't otherwise occupied, I could get down and stand in line and get a rush seat at the Philadelphia Orchestra. In those days, it was 50 cents. And you know, hear the symphony in the days when records weren't very good and not much of it was broadcast. I went with my brother as often as not, and he's 5 years older than me. He did the same thing. And of course, we went to the library and we were going, does that mean we have to put another disc in?
Unrelated.
And so, you know, there was this kind of attitude. My father's a total dime-breaker. I didn't grow up in an academic or professional family. But the family had a lot of curiosity. And we read the papers, and we talked about the news, and the news included what's going on at the Art Museum or the Symphony or something. And that attitude, I don't know if it's still around, you know, a lot of these kids. So I say, I began to think my faculty, my colleagues, I told you first part of the, yeah, look, I was talking about music. My grandsons, I'm sure, know a lot about music. They just don't know anything about the kind of music I know about, and I don't know anything about the kind of music they know about. So it's not that maybe they're not curious, they're just not curious about what I'm curious about. But, you know, there's that kind of a, and it's partly a generational shift, I don't know. The mass culture, I was just talking to Bob Fendot yesterday. The communication department retirees get together for the last couple of years and have a picnic. Our dear former chairman, Ted Wolver, he's still around and he still organizes things. So Bob Fendot was there, we were talking, he lives in Pittsburgh, and we go to Nancy and I go to the opera, we go to the theater. Ken Harris was there, he's the former head of the theater department. But if I looked around at other members of the retirees who are there, I don't see any of them, you know. So whether it's a difference of interests, I don't know. It's like, of course, the fact is, I took my kids to symphony and they don't go anymore.
Okay.
One of them is really into theater. Actually, all of them would probably go to the theater. Hey, did your mother give you dancing lessons when you were small?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mine did too. But they don't know the ballet. I mean, my kids got it, you know. Whatever.
Okay.
The fact is, I also took them to band. I had the feeling the kids ought to grow up feeling at home at a baseball game. We took them to the college football games. We take them occasionally to see the Pirates play, you know, that they ought to be at home in almost any kind of activity that's part of the broad spectrum of American culture. And I hope that's true for the undergraduates, but sometimes I wonder.
All right, how would you like to be remembered?
Coming up on 80. A lady sat behind me at the theater last time I went, tapped me on the shoulder and said, "How are you, Dr. Gore?" And I turned around, of course I wouldn't recognize her after all, but the last time I'd seen her, she was probably 22 years old. Well, I asked her when did she get out, and I think she said 60, somewhere in the 60s. She's now retired from teaching. I'd like to be remembered. I like people to think, not only do I remember you, but I hope it's kindly. But I'm sure some people think I was a bore. When you teach 25 students, there's probably a couple who get some sense of where you're really trying to go, and some who aren't going to make it through college anyhow, just filling up space, because they can't think of what else to do with themselves. I think, I started teaching as a grad assistant in 1949. I retired in the fall semester of 1991. Has there been a change in the students? Oh, all right. With that expansion, when I went to college, well, it was a major shift. And World War II is a marker. My own brother, who's 5 years older than me, couldn't afford to go to college when he got out of high school. He went eventually on the GI Bill. None of my first cousins who was older than me went to college, male or female. Every one of my first cousins, beginning well with my brother, and one cousin was a year older than me, and all of us younger than me went to college. If you go back to the 30s, I don't know if even 20% of the population even tried to go to college, and maybe 10% finished. And now we want to send 50 or 60% of the population. So we're educating a different group of people. Now, I'm not saying they're not capable, but they're being drawn from different stratas of the social system, I guess. We made college kind of broad, and I have no problem with that. My problem is I think there are a lot of people in college is an academic thing. Not all intelligence is the kind of intelligence that works in the classroom. And I think there are people sitting in those classrooms who would be much more successful and I suspect happy if they were apprenticed as electricians or machinists like my father, you know, or other trades that make them do things rather than sit still and listen. You know, they're not book learners. Mm-hmm. And because they don't know what to do with themselves, they come to college. And then after a while, you know, what's the attrition rate? About half. Mm-hmm. Only about 40% graduate in 4 years, right? You throw in another 10% if you round it up to 6. So about half the students or a third of the students who come really aren't, I won't say they're not college material, really don't have the learning styles and the interest that fit being in college. And obviously they create problems for the teachers, and we probably create problems for them. But I don't know, in this present economy, we make college degrees and necessary for all kinds of things, which used to be doable with a high school diploma, probably.
Okay, do you have anything else you'd like to add that we haven't touched on yet?
What else is on your list that I may not have touched on? Oh my, it was an interesting life. I enjoyed it for the most part. Always had good friends. Best and worst teaching moments. I think I contributed some to the college, as I say. What was it? Repeat your question.
Anything else you'd like to throw into the mix?
I like young people. I still like them. I suspected my teaching style. That was the other thought I had. Teachers have teaching styles and students have learning styles. And if they mesh, the student's happy with the teacher and vice versa. If they don't mesh, the student isn't. That may not mean that student won't go down the hall and take a different teacher and be happy. You know. So, let's see what goes. It was an interesting life. I don't regret a bit of it. And I'm always glad I came to Slippery Rock. My wife and I were very happy here. We used to wonder about the kids growing. We both went to selective high schools in big cities and academic preparatory programs. And our kids went to Slippery Rock High. And I thought, oh my goodness. But you know, the kids did okay when they got to college. The middle daughter went to Carnegie Mellon, came home and said, you know, I didn't learn much in my high school physics class, but I discovered nobody else did either, so I guess I'll make it. You know, so it's like that. They got an education because they wanted to get an education. And by the way, that one's an engineer. I'm proud of my kids. You don't want to get me on that. So, I was in town yesterday visiting a couple of old friends who were academics. Unfortunately, we're all getting up in years.
All right, well, on behalf of myself and Lindsay and Rob Voice, I'd like to thank you for coming in today.
Thank you to your good audience that encouraged me to talk. If you hadn't responded, I would have probably shut up.
All right.